Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll talk with Jay Nugaboran, whose new book, Dickens in Brooklyn, Essays on Family, Writing, and Madness, are a collection of essays in which he explores experiences that have been central to his life, caring long-term for a brother with mental illness, finding and connecting with long-lost family members, a posthumous lunch with Oliver Sacks, his years as a single parent to his three children, his decision as a General Motors executive trainee to violate company policy and hang out with the hourlies, and a thwarted kiss at a teenage summer camp where he was a young Jewish man in exile among Jews. Jay Nugaboran has authored 25 books, including more than half dozen award-winning books of both fiction and nonfiction, four collections of prize-winning stories. His many awards include fellowships with Guggenheim Foundation, National Endowment of the Arts. He's author of two award-winning screenplays as well. And he taught at University of Massachusetts Amherst for many years. He's also taught at Stanford, Columbia, SUNY Old Westbury, Boston University, and University of Freiburg in Germany. So Jay Nugaboran, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Tom.
So a fascinating collection. These are essays over a span of several years?
Many. Most of them were written in the last half dozen years, but some go back more than 30 years.
Yeah. So this is, you consider this as a collection, a memoir, but the centered on family, also in your career as a writer, I think.
Yeah, I think it is really a memoir in the form of separate essays about key experiences in my life, but I didn't put them together in a single narrative. This way I could focus on each experience in a particular way, not as part of the story of my life. And I think that way, as when I write about being a junior executive for General Motors or in the Merchant Marines, I can really, it's not about me so much, I think, but I'm a guide to the reader about what that experience would be like for someone else.
Where does inspiration come from with you? I think in interviews I've read, you say, memory, little snippets of memory come to you in unexpected ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they. It may be a little bit of a function of getting older, but the past begins to be more vivid sometimes than it was when I experienced it. Almost dreamlike in a certain way, but very specific. And for me, one of the pleasures of growing old is the ability to sort of go back in time and live through parts of my life again when I write them down.
So go back and reliving that, isn't it for some of the painful things? Do you still have the pain, or is that at a remove now?
I would say it's at a remove. Mm-hmm. For me, I've written a fair amount about my relationship with my brother, several essays in this book, who spent most of his life in and out of mental hospitals and half psych wards. Very unpleasant experiences for sure for him, and also for the family to live with someone who has a chronic mental illness. But for me, it's always the difficult part is making the decision to write about something that personal. But once I've made the decision, then there's no pain. It's simply a question of making it as clear and vivid as I can for readers and for me too, so I can remember it accurately.
What are the factors that go into making a decision about writing something personal? Is it the people that you're writing about, that concerns about them? What goes into that decision?
I would say the degree to which it doesn't leave me alone. It's a memory or an experience that I can't stop thinking about, and that says to me, write me down, tell this story. And for me, it's almost always my comes as storytelling. I mean, I was a novelist before I began writing essays that are called memoirs or essays in autobiography. And I always, I look back and try to find out what are the stories that made up my life and would they be interesting to other people? And when the answer to both questions are yes, I go ahead and begin to try to write it down.
You have published 9 books now since you turned 70. So a very productive period in your older age. What do you attribute that to?
Good fortune, good health. But also I would say, not having as many responsibilities as I had when I was a younger man. I was a single parent to 3 children. I was caretaker for my brother during his years. I was guardian for my mother in her last years. And when I was raising my 3 children, I had a big old house in Massachusetts. Now it's, you know, pretty much just me, you know, in an apartment in New York City. I'm not teaching full-time. I do a little part-time teaching at Columbia. So I don't have the responsibilities and demands on my time that I had when I was younger. I'm really, one gift of growing older is that I feel time-rich. And so I get up, I write every day. When I was raising my children, I couldn't write every day. Some days I said, well, today I'm not a writer, I'm a parent. I've got to get one of my kids to the doctor. I've got to have a conference with a teacher. I've got to get one of our old cars to the garage. You know. But now I'm pretty much time rich, and I'm using that time as best I can.
Hmm. Let's talk about the title essay, Dickens in Brooklyn. I wonder if you'd read the first part of that essay.
Yeah, well, so let me read the opening.
That. Yeah.
Dickens in Brooklyn. My parents were married at 6 o'clock on Sunday evening, October 25th, 1936, at the Quincy Manor in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn. And a week or so later, they began clipping coupons from the front page of the New York Post, one coupon a day, and mailing them to the Post, 24 coupons at a time, which coupons, along with 93 cents, brought them 4 volumes of a 20-volume set of the complete works of Charles Dickens. A set that, with full-page illustrations, was printed from plates Harper and Brothers had used for older, more expensive sets. The Post's promotion began in January 1936 and expired on May 16th, 1938, 2 weeks before I was born. And when 82 years later, in the week of June 9th, not 2020, a week that marked the 150th anniversary of Dickens' death, I was isolated in my New York City apartment due to the COVID-19 lockdown, it occurred to me that this might be a good time to do what I'd often thought of doing, reread all of Dickens. The Post was the first newspaper in the United States to offer complete sets of Dickens. This kind of marketing campaign, whose primary purpose was to increase circulation, was known as a continuity program. And it originated in England, where a young Englishman, John Stevenson, had used similar promotional methods to help increase the circulation of the London Daily Herald from 350,000 to over 1 million within a year. In 1936, when he was 20 years old, Stevenson came to New York and worked for the Post. After a spell there, he went on to work for newspapers and department stores in a wide range of cities, including Boston, Detroit, Milwaukee, and Syracuse, and would distribute millions of books, including complete sets of works by Shakespeare, Robert Louis Stevenson, Mark Twain, Honoré de Balzac, Victor Hugo, and Joseph Conrad.
Yeah, it's very vivid imagery. I can see it. You know, I guess in my family we had the encyclopedia. They're status symbols, right? Symbols of aspiration that your parents probably
yes.
had.
Yes. Yeah, I yeah. agree. My parents from the Post. Excuse me. They also received got a 2-volume dictionary, which I still have. They also received a big folio of prints of Van Gogh paintings, which unfortunately were stored poorly by my parents and molded away. But it was a way, like having a piano, that indicated you had risen up in the world culturally.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents read from these volumes, or were they just kind of for show for them?
I read them. I don't mm-hmm. recall my parents, either of my parents, ever reading them. But I devoured them as a boy.
So it was a hit with you. That's good. Yeah. I just want to read this paragraph, that kind of a connection between Dickens and your family. You say, other than the time my mother and I read to each other from the opening pages of Great Expectations, I don't recall seeing my father or mother actually reading a book of Dickens. And yet, in memory, our family life, a mid-20th century Brooklyn world determined by difficult economic circumstances, inhabited by eccentric larger-than-life characters, rooted in family feuds about inheritance and money, and steeped in scenes of intense high drama, seems distinctly Dickensian. There's a definite connection there, obviously.
Yeah, well, it was we were not your typically warm, fuzzy Jewish family. And and when I read Dickens, the melodrama in Dickens parallels the melodrama in my childhood family. My grandparents, for example, did not live together. When they came together, they fought. My mother had a very vivid memory of watching my grandmother throw my grandfather down a flight of stairs. My grandmother did not speak with my mother for the last 8 years of her life. And the parents set the children. My mother was one of 8 children, 2 of whom had died in Europe before the family came to America. And my mother didn't speak to a sister and a brother for a long, long periods of time. It depended who sided with which parent. Mm. And my grandparents, unheard of then, did not come to my grandmother, and aunts and some of my aunts and uncles didn't come to my bar mitzvah. Very unusual for a Jewish. It was much more a Russian family out of Dostoevsky than a Jewish family out of Seinfeld, let's say.
Your mother was very colorful, very dramatic. She would, top of her lungs, bemoan for your father to earn more.
Yeah, my mother was a formidable woman. They came from a poor family. She went to nursing school on her own, finished first in her class at nursing school in New York City. And nursing in those days was not considered an honorable vocation for a young woman, Jewish woman, because you had to touch bodies, which was considered not good for a Jewish woman. But my mother supported our family. She would often work double shifts, 16 straight hours. My father, who was, he never made an excuse for it, but he was blind in one eye and legally blind in the other eye, and he never really earned a living. And my mother would rake him over the coals, really, for not being able to support her and for the fact that she had to work so hard, unlike the wives of other men she would name, friends of hers, where the woman could stay at home and be homemakers and go shopping or do whatever they wanted. So they were always threatening divorce. My mother would go away for long periods. My father would go sometimes and stay with one of his brothers or sisters. They never did get divorced, but there were a lot of battles and a lot of bitterness.
You said, I'll just quote this sentence, you say, while I was reading or writing, I could for a while be shut of such feelings and transported to a world that, no matter how terrifying, mad, strange, or cruel, was not the world I actually lived in. I want to talk about you becoming a writer. You wrote a novel at 8 years old?
Yeah, I wrote a novel when I was 8 years old. And I would read a chapter every week on Monday morning. My teacher, wonderful woman named, Greek woman named Mrs. Dimitri, who had a daughter, I remember, named Demeter. And she said, Jay, do you have a new chapter for us? Yes, I do, Mrs. Dimitri. And I get up and read it, and my friends in the class would always come up to me at recess or lunch and say, so what happens next? What happens next? And I would say, I don't know until I write it. But I never wrote again or thought of being a writer until I left home, basically, which was interesting. But I did love, I mean, when I was a boy, the two things that kept me whole, saved me, were reading and playing ball. In both ways, I got out of my family. Mm. By reading, I entered other worlds. And when I went to the schoolyard or found a bunch of friends in the streets to play stickball or punchball, I was also free. I was not at home. I was in a different world.
You say you devoured those Dickens volumes. Of course, Dickens' world, you know, it's not all puppies and clouds. It's a lot of suffering going on there. But I guess it was a different world. You could escape into it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You remember other books that were important to you growing up?
Well, the very first book I recall reading was a Dr. Doolittle book, if anyone remembers those, which was about a man who could communicate with animals. But the other books I loved growing up with the John R. Tunis novels, which were all about sports, mostly about baseball. I remember I loved the Black Stallion books by Walter Farley. And in my graduation book, when I was 13 years old, I listed as one of my favorite books, The Caine Mutiny by Herman Wouk. Mm. And I think now I wonder how many young people in America would read a big, thick book like that now when they were 12 or 13 years old. And then later on in high school, I discovered other writers I loved. I love Willa Cather. I discovered her when I was in high school. Steinbeck and Hemingway, of course. I would go to the library, and you were allowed to take four books home, and I would take four books home and usually bring them back within the week.
Yeah, that's wonderful memories Yeah, wonderful. Now, many books that you've written later. Let's time for a break. Let's take a brief break. We'll come back, talk more with Jay Nugaborn. The latest is a collection of essays called Dickens in Brooklyn, Essays on Family, Writing, and Madness. More following this brief break.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, a conversation with the co-creators and stars of the hit off-Broadway musical, Mexodus, Nigel D. Robinson and Brian Quijada. We go deep into the history of the Underground Railroad south to Mexico, and we talk about what their musical can teach us about cross-racial and cross-border solidarity. That's next time on Latino USA.
Tune in Tuesday morning at 11 here on UPR.
Programming support here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members and the American Festival Chorus and Orchestra, presenting Brahms Requiem, April 25th at 7:30 p.m. in the Danes Concert Hall. Tickets available at AmericanFestivalChorus.org.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased today to have the author Jay Nugaborn with us. He's author of 25 books, including more than a half dozen award-winning books of both fiction and nonfiction, four collections of prize-winning stories, author of two award-winning screenplays as well. His latest is Dickens in Brooklyn, Essays on Family, Writing, and Madness. Jay Nugaborn, before the break, we talked a little bit about you becoming a writer. 8 years old, you write a novel, well-received in your class. I think your mother kind of fussed over it, was proud of it. Then you go on to say that when you came time to go to college, writing was not expressed. I think it was, I can't remember what it was, architectural engineering was something you wanted to study. When did the desire to write resurface? How did that resurface?
During my first year of college, I was away from home, and I was at Columbia, which celebrated, as it still does, the humanities. There was a core curriculum in which every Columbia student, whether they were pre-engineering, pre-med, pre-law, accounting, or classics, had to read a book a week in the humanities course, starting with Homer, with the Odyssey or the Iliad, and going on to, by the end of the year, to Dostoevsky. And I just once again fell in love with books and decided I wanted to write them. By my second year at Columbia, I did write a complete novel that was championed by one of my professors, who sent it to his publisher for me. And I thought I was, for a week or two, I thought I was going to be the American equivalent of Françoise Sagan and be a celebrated novelist at 19 years old, but that didn't happen. And by my senior year, I'd written a second novel. And that was it. I mean, there was nothing else in terms of what I wanted to do with my life, nothing else I really wanted to do.
You say you accumulated nearly 3,000 rejections before the age of 27. That's when you sold your first novel. What 3,000 rejections? How do you, I guess you just keep going. You have an intense desire to be a writer. That's the only thing that carries you through that?
Yeah, I took a sort of perverse pride in being able to come back. I had 8 unpublished books by the time I was 28, and my first novel was published. And I remember I did get an agent at one point for my 6th novel, And I called, when it was turned down, I called my agent and said, look, I'm sure you have more important writers than me. Why don't you? And she sort of shouted at me. She said, you're a very good writer. I am going to see that you're published someday. You keep writing. I will sell your books. You will see. Mm-hmm. And eventually I did get published. But I, as I write in one of the essays in this collection, early on, one day when I was typing up a list so I could keep track of where my books were and the short stories I was writing, I hit the tab key on an old Underwood manual typewriter, and at the far right, I suddenly put in 500 to 1. I put in odds. And then I kept doing it with all my stories and books. And at the bottom, and I put at the top something, Neugeborn scoreboard. And at the bottom, I put a daily double, a long shot. And I've been doing that ever since for 60 years. Mm. I have a scoreboard right now pasted to my wall. I also kept a running score of them against us. Mm. So I did keep track of most of the rejections and acceptances, because I began, you know, having my stories, articles, and books published.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember at all the odds that you assigned to the first one you got published? Probably were pretty long odds. You didn't expect to have it published. Yeah.
They were long odds.
Yeah.
They were long odds.
What advice would you give to aspiring writers?
You know, stay with it. If it's what you love to do, stay with it. But I would also say you cannot wait for inspiration. And I quote Flannery O'Connor, who says, you know, routine is a condition of survival. And in a letter to a young writer, she says, you know, you can't wait for inspiration. You go to your desk every day at the same time, or whatever schedule you can manage, but it has to be a routine. If you can only write on weekends, let's say from 6 to 9 in the evenings, then that is sacrosanct. You turn off the phone, you turn off your email, and because you can get one book done if you wait to be inspired. But to have a career as a writer, the only thing I know, and that most writers I know, the only thing we know is you have to have a regular routine. And there may be days when you get nothing done. And that's okay too, because what you're doing is you're deciding, you're making choices about what not to write, which is sometimes as important as what to write.
I wanted to, if you just joined us, we're talking with Jay Neugeborene. His latest book is Dickens in Brooklyn, Essays on Family, Writing, and Madness. I want to talk about your brother Robert. It's a big part of your life. 5 years younger than you, decades dealing with mental illness. And you love him and you're trying to help him, and you know, times of desperation and times of joy as well. Tell us in brief what kind of, I guess, what kind of boy and what kind of man Robert was, his personality.
My brother was a very, as you indicate, he had a very unenviable life, most of which was spent in and out of mental hospitals, psych wards, halfway houses. But he was a very gifted young man, very enormously funny. He was a very gifted dancer, singer, always had the leads in plays, won a scholarship to college. He was a good athlete, good tennis player. He was very good chess player. As a matter of fact, Bobby Fischer was in the chess club with him when they were both 14 years old at Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn. Fisher was the national junior champion in chess. He wouldn't play with my brother. Robert was good, but Robert was also very imaginative. And I said, well, why won't he, this kid won't play with you? He says, because he says, Newborn, you play crazy. Meaning my brother would surprise Fisher with his moves. And Fisher played by the book. Always. He knew every move that had ever been made. And but anyway, Robert was a delightful young man, and then had a major breakdown and was hospitalized at the age of 19, recovered, finished 2 years of college, and then broke again, and never recovered into a full life. But he did recover by the end of his life into some very good years where we spent a lot of time together. He got around the city on his own, and he was a joy. He was a, people often said, oh, how awful, you know, how awful and how good of you to take care of him. And I said, you know, it's not just a one-way street. I get a lot from him. Mm. He knows me better than anybody else, you know. He loves me. He gets pissed at me. I get pissed at him. We're brothers. I miss him.
Mm. Yeah. How did he deal with his mental illness? I guess it would, you know, there'd be times of more lucidity and others of breakdowns. And what did he think about all of that? Of course, you don't, you know, don't want your mental illness. You'd prefer to not have it.
There's no way to make anything good out of having a long-term mental illness. Robert never, he was lucid until the end of his life. Intellectually, certainly. He would go off once in a while or off center, go into rages, but he never in any way, and once in a while he would break down and just say, Jay, you don't know what it's like. You don't know how awful it is. And he was always, I thought, had a double consciousness. He was in the world he was in. Even when he was on psych wards, he would always make friends with people. The staff, when he wasn't angry, would always take delight in him because he was, when he was, let's say, sober, he was a very interesting guy. He read widely. He knew movies. He was just, but it was a hard life. Mm. It was a very hard life. And he says, you don't know what it's like. But he always had a double sense, I was saying, of where he was, that he was in a hospital or on a psych ward, that he could not function on his own. And he also always had a sense of the life he had not lived. Mm. What his life would have been like if he had not had these early breakdowns. Mm-hmm. And that was made for a very profound sadness.
And you write that, or you said that these kind of characters appear in many of your novels. People whose future, as it might have been, was stolen from them, diverted by whatever circumstance.
Yeah, it's... It's hard on the person, certainly, and it's hard on the family. I've met my parents, for example, abandoned Robert before he was 30 years old when he was in Creedmoor State Hospital, psychiatric center, a hospital that then in the late 60s, early 70s, had 7,000 patients. And it was a god-awful place. Robert was beaten up there. I would call to find out how he was. The doctors would not have seen him for a week or two. They didn't even know who he was or where to find. It was a terrible place. My parents left. and moved to Florida. My father died 3 years later, never saw him again. My mother lived another 30 years. She only saw him twice in the 30 years. And once we had gone, Robert had made his way, he was in a very good period, on his own by bus from New York City to Ithaca, New York, for the bar mitzvahs of two of his cousins. And we were at dinner the night before, on a Friday night, the night before the bar mitzvahs, and we were sitting across from my mother. And my mother reaches across to Robert, and she puts her hand out, and she says, "Hello, I'm Ann Neugeborn. Who are you?" And Robert says, "I'm Robert Neugeborn, your son." Hmm. And she says, "Oh, my God." She had not recognized him. Extraordinary.
Yeah, that is extraordinary, yeah.
So, I mean, people, there was one residence he was living in for a half dozen years on the, in the Hell's Kitchen section of New York City in the 50s on the West Side. I visited him once or twice a week for all 6 years. The entire home, a brownstone, very nice brownstone. He had his own room, functioned fairly well. I never saw another family member visit one of the people in his residence in the 6 years. Out of sight, out of mind, usually for people with long-term mental illness, usually means out of sight. They are abandoned, or very often, too often, by family and friends.
You write that Robert's diagnoses would change according to the drugs that seemed to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, if he was, if lithium worked, they'd say, "Oh, he must be manic depressive." If Haldol worked, or Thorazine worked, "Oh, he must be schizophrenic." I don't, you know, and Robert would say, "I don't have a mental illness. I have emotional problems," he would say. But the diagnoses, I have an essay which is not in this book called The Consolation of Diagnosis. I think, "Oh, your brother's schizophrenic." I say, "Yeah. So what does that tell you about Robert?" Mm. Doesn't tell you anything about him, about who he is as a person, and or even what his illness is.
Yeah. But we do tend to pigeonhole people, right?
Yes.
He's schizophrenic. Yeah, but as you say, it doesn't say anything about Robert. Yeah. You write that Robert's quite proud of the book you wrote about him, Imagining Robert, My Brother, Madness and Survival. What did that book do for him and for you?
He loved the book. I mean, he collaborated with me on it. And we would have times when I would, you know, we would have sessions where I talk with him about our childhood or about his hospitalizations. And we found out, like most brothers, most children and families, we had different parents. The parents he described and that I described were not exactly the same. And sometimes he would come up to visit me. He was in New York. I was in Massachusetts then. He would get on a bus, come up to Massachusetts, spend a weekend with me and my family. And sometimes after we'd had one session, later in the day, he said, "Jacob, we have another session." He enjoyed going back and revisiting his life, even the hospitalizations. And when the book came out, I remember he opened it. I brought it to him. And he turned to the frontispiece, which shows me and Robert in a very pastoral scene. And he's an infant, and I'm holding him in my lap, sort of a Madonna and child, but two Jewish brothers. And he looks at it and he goes like this, kisses his lips, kisses the picture. He says, Jay, this is something no one can ever take away from us. So he was very proud of the book. He would sometimes come with me when I gave readings. And at the premiere of the, he would come with me and answer questions from the audience. And then there was a movie, a documentary film based on the book, Imagining Robert, that he was the star in, really. I mean, his acting ability. I mean, he on camera, the camera loves him, and he loved the camera. And he appeared at the premiere of the film in Northampton, and at the premiere in New York City premiere at Mount Sinai Hospital, and was very engaging with the public during it. I mean, mental illness, so-called mental illness, is not what a lot of people think it is. He was totally coherent at times and totally could be objective about his experience.
You're right. The near the end of the one of the last essays in the book, Death of a Mental Patient, upon Robert's death, you say that from the time of your father's death in 1976, you'd been carrying on imaginary conversations with him, your father, and others as well. And then you recount a poignant conversation with the now deceased Robert. Did you, I guess, that a way to bring closure? What's going on with those imaginary conversations?
Closure is not a word I would choose. I don't. Mm-hmm. I think for certain kinds of attachments, friendships, love, the deaths of people close to you, I don't know that there's ever closure. But I do have imaginary conversations with Robert, with my father. It's a way of keeping them alive in me. I don't know. I also find that they, as in a novel, they will suddenly, when I'm talking to them in my imagination, they'll surprise me. They'll say very surprising things. And Robert will say, oh, Jay, stop it. Do you really believe that? I mean, Robert would always check me out, you know, on stuff.
We're talking with Jay Nugaboran. His latest book is Dickens in Brooklyn, Essays on Family, Writing, and Madness. Let's take another break. We'll come back with the final segment following this brief break.
A geologist, a planetary scientist, a NASA mission leader, and an expert on team building walk into a bar. And the bartender says, hey, Lindy, drinking alone today? How to be an interdisciplinarian, that's Undisciplined, Thursday morning at 10:30 on UPR.
I'm Julie Rose, host of the Top of Mind podcast. Was America founded by divine intervention, or profit-seeking slaveholders, or noble men in pursuit of freedom?
Having a coherent story is really essential. But in our case, it's a particularly complicated undertaking and always has been.
The angst over America's founding story and why it matters is Top of Mind.
Tune in Sunday morning at 9 here on UPR.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the author Jay Nugaboran, author of 25 books, many of them award-winning. The latest is Dickens in Brooklyn, Essays on Family, Writing, and Madness. I want to talk at least briefly, Jay Nugaboran, about your essay titled My Cousin Manya, Survivor of Auschwitz. You have many cousins. How did you connect with Manya? Tell us about Manya.
Yeah, I had, by count, when I was growing up, I had 37 first cousins, most of whom lived within walking distance. except for two who lived in what I thought when I was a child in Brooklyn was a foreign country called the Bronx. But my cousin Manu was a distant cousin, not a first cousin, a second cousin, whom I did not meet until I was, I guess, around 50 years old, and she was 60 years old. Manya was a survivor of Auschwitz, the death camp. And I got a letter one day forwarded to me from the New York Times saying, my name is Manya Gerlich Eisner. I was in Auschwitz for 3 years. I survived. When I was a young woman, I remember that a cousin of mine had gone to America and married a man with an unusual name, the name of Neugeboren. And I've always been meaning to look into it to see if we were somehow who that was. And so she had written to me, because I'd had an essay in the opinion page of the New York Times. I wonder if there is any relation, et cetera. So I called her up. She had her phone number in, and I noticed, told her right away, Manya Gerlich, your middle name, that is my grandmother's maiden name. And that was her family name, I forget, the mother or father's side. And she lived in Ellenville, New York, upstate New York, and was coming into the city the next day to see an eye doctor for, she had macular degeneration. And we got together the next day. I had some information from census reports of in the early 1900s, and we met, we talked, and we figured out that Gerlich was as unusual a name as Neugeboren. If I ever meet anyone in the States whose name is Neugeboren or even Newborn, it turns out they always came from the little shtetl, little village where my grandparents and aunts and uncles came from. And the same was true of Gerlich. In any event, it turned out that we were second cousins. And I was the first person on the father's side of her family that she had met since the end of World War II. She had 8 brothers and sisters. They were all killed in Auschwitz. Her mother and father also. They were all burned and cremated, so to speak, in the ovens of Auschwitz. And I made a party. I invited all the Neugeborens I could from New York City and Connecticut, New Jersey, whom I was in touch with, to meet Manya. And we became dear friends, in addition to being cousins, for the rest of her life. She died at, I think, 97 years old. A very vital woman.
You write that hearing her experiences, stories of surviving Nazi concentration camps, remind you that, quoting you, that a person who does not believe in miracles is not a realist. That was quite a quote.
Yeah, well, but you know. What a miracle for her. It was for everybody. When I would meet friends of hers in Ellenville and her family, her son and her grandchildren, but anyone I met, she would say, oh, Manya told me about how you met. She couldn't stop talking about the fact that family had been given back to her in this life. In some way. And we talked about other things too. She was a very literate woman. First time I remember when I went up to visit her, she was listening to books on auto. Her vision was not good. She was listening to a novel by Henry James. She didn't speak English when she came to America, but she went with a friend who was registering for classes at the State University of New Paltz. And the friend said, "Why don't you register?" And Manya says, I'm not a student. I don't know English that well." Long story short, she graduated with honors from college several years later. She was an exceptional woman, had a lovely, dark sense of humor. How not? I remember her saying, describing one of her jobs that saved her life in Auschwitz was carting away dead bodies with a wheelbarrow, or she would go around the grounds, and where people fell down dead, she and another Jewish woman would pick them up, put them on the cart, and take them to where they would eventually be incinerated. And she said, "Can you imagine when there stopped being so many people dying and I lost my job? I was unhappy to have lost my job." And she understood the deep Kafkaesque irony in that situation, to be unhappy to lose a job carting away dead Jews. She was a remarkable woman, and I loved her and I miss her.
Well, we'd much else we could talk about. Pick up the book. There's much else in the book. Fascinating essays. Dickens in Brooklyn, Essays on Family, Writing, and Madness. We've reached the end of our hour with Jay Nugaborn. Jay Nugaborn, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Tom.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.